Today on Vox Talks Economics, where gender-biased norms came from and why they don't go away. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, follow us, and you'll find clips and more information on Instagram as well, at Vox Talks Economics. The belief that women are in some way inferior to men, so popular among a certain group of men right now, has been around for centuries. And throughout that time, women have suffered the consequences. Economists have lately been trying to understand how gender norms came about, to document their impact, and to evaluate the policies designed to change those norms. So what do we know, and where are the gaps in this knowledge? In an article written for the Handbook of Cultural Economics and Behaviour, it's also published as a CEPR discussion paper, Shuan Anderson of Vancouver School of Economics, the University of British Columbia, and CEPR, of course, has brought together the research on these questions. She joins me now. Shuan, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thanks very much, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Shuan, in most places, women and men do different tasks in the household, different jobs in the workplace. Has it always been this way?
Yes, essentially. The sexual division of labor is essentially universal, and it likely originated from human pair bonding and task specialization, simply compatible with childcare. So childcare is almost universally performed by women. Mm-hmm. So it tends to be compatible with economic activities that can be stopped and resumed, ones that don't put the children in danger or require the worker to be away from home for long periods of time. So this has corresponded to different types of agricultural production technologies and so forth.
But it's possible to be different but equal. Do we understand why men became socially dominant?
No, this is what I think is a much bigger puzzle. So there are hypotheses outside of economics, but in economics, we've done very little to understand this most fundamental question, because a sexual division of labor, which improves economic efficiency, is not necessarily a bad thing in its own right. So I think this is exactly where we need to move forward. We've sort of really focused on just economic differences explaining gender bias norms, and I think that's something we can really move towards understanding better.
How recent is this idea that it would be a good idea to challenge gender-biased norms?
First, I think we do need to acknowledge, even though the sexual division of labor is a universal, there's very different ways that has played out and also how that has affected gender bias norms. But with respect to Western industrialized countries, it's really only been within the last two centuries that researchers conjectured this movement has its original roots in the Age of Enlightenment, with a focus on universal human rights, and the rise of Protestantism in Western Europe had a big impact because it promoted female education. And these led to very early female thinkers from this period, which really formed the genesis of the women's rights movement, which only took foot in the 20th century.
There has been a lot of work in the 20th century in sociology and anthropology. I remember being given these books by my mum to read to investigate gender bias norms. What can economists contribute to our knowledge in this area?
I think they can contribute a lot, both empirically and conceptually. So I think we're doing a lot, you know, with regards to trying to measure them and empirically explore these issues. But I also think, just for example, those core hypotheses that come out of those other literatures, we haven't explored. So one core hypothesis, recognizing the sexual division of labor isn't, you know, necessarily a problem in its own right, is that what happened with the social subjugation of women resulted from the emergence of private property and wealth inequality. But why?
Right.
You know, so for example, wealth inequality does not necessarily need to be linked to gender equality, especially given that wealth and property are typically held by families, which unite men and women. So we have very little understanding of why gender inequality necessarily follows. And economists would ask, why is that necessarily an equilibrium outcome? And we would have more quite in-depth conceptual frameworks for that, rather than just putting it forward as a hypothesis. There's many hypotheses to test. Another one is just sexual dominance. A big hypothesis is that paternity uncertainty led to sexual dominance, which drove a lot of this. But again, why does that need to be an equilibrium outcome? And that's where economists would head.
We'll investigate what we know so far in economics and what we don't know in a second.
If you missed our episodes recorded at the Paris School of Economics CEPR Forum on the topic of women at work, now's a great time to catch up. So listen to Barbara Petrongolo on gender and the labour market, Marianne Bertrand on why Japanese men don't take paternity leave, or Stefan Carcillo on closing the gender wage gap. All available from July and August this year.
So, Sharon, when we are investigating this in economics, what sort of biases against women can we estimate or can we measure?
So what we're typically relying on for contemporary measures is attitudinal surveys, which directly ask about implicit biases. So there are now many surveys where you're asked, are men more deserving of more opportunities like to education, work and employment, or even political positions? There are a lot of large-scale surveys which ask whether it's justified for men to beat their wives if women transgress certain gender norms, like she argues with her husband, goes out of the house without telling them, neglects the children, or even burns the food. And more experimental methods in economics are sort of borrowing from psychology, like implicit association tests, where lab participants are asked to rapidly associate some sort of gender roles or gender-biased ideas with images of males and females. And because they're doing it so quickly, you can measure implicit bias in those. So we're relying on this data, and we're innovating all the time on how we can capture gender bias norms.
But let's go back in time, that innovation. I was surprised in reading your paper to find out that economists have been using historical data to estimate these gender biases in antiquity, a long way further back in history than I was expecting. What have they done and what do we find?
Yeah, so for there, we first relied on ethnographic data, which would have been originally collected by anthropologists. But again, economists are interested in the global scale of these and trying to compare this regionally. So they document a lot of different cultural practices that can be deemed gender biased, like male-dominated descent systems or inheritance systems, gender-biased marital customs like bride capture, child marriage, rules of male guardianship, or female infanticide, female genital mutilation, those kind of things. There's a very interesting global database generated from folklore studies, where you're relying on the oral histories that societies pass down across the generations, and you can characterize these into different motifs or themes. So you can construct a measure of whether these narratives entail some notions of gender bias, whether they're more likely to associate women with domestic roles or subordinate behaviors and men with dominant roles or violent behaviors. It's very interesting to map this across the world and regionally and by ethnic group. And we can do that, and we've been trying to estimate the determinants of that.
When you do that, do you find that these biases have been consistent around the world?
No, there's definitely huge variation. And even now, you know, when women are practicing seclusion from the public sphere, that doesn't necessarily mean they have no autonomy or rights in their private sphere within the household. Norms within the public and private sphere don't necessarily move together. But also just considering that folklore data and taking, say, a domestic bias versus a subordination bias, both against women, those will be correlated in certain regions, but also not move together. So for example, you know, in South Asia and Latin America, you'll observe a low degree of domesticity bias, but a high degree of subordination bias. In other parts of the African continent and the Philippines, you actually observe less historical bias on both of these dimensions. So there's very few consistent patterns. And I think it's this variation, which is really fascinating to explore, and we can understand a lot from trying to do that.
Now, as you say, a lot of the contemporary research is using surveys to capture opinions. Isn't it more important to capture outcomes rather than opinions?
That's exactly where we were before. So rightly so. We studied outcomes instead. So we tried to analyze female labor participation, experience of intimate partner violence rather than attitudes. So this was our main focus of research. It's much more recently we've turned to try and understand culture and norms as well. And this is for good reasons. So for example, formal female labor force participation, it is not increased as we would expect in many parts of the world, particularly in South Asia and in the Middle East, even though education of women has increased substantially. And a big conjecture for why that's the case is sticky gender bias norm. So that's why we've gone into this area. So the original question could still just to be to try to understand female labor force participation.
I'm interested in how these norms have evolved in more recent history. So in the 20th century, for example, then we find more women in the labor force. Did that increase demand for female labor? Has that affected norms?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big conjecture in economics. And that's also where we started, which was the large-scale improvements in gender bias norms recently was the big influx of women into the formal labor force participation. And this transformation just challenged these traditional norms that women didn't need to be in the household, that men didn't need to be the main breadwinners, that women could also contribute financially. But there is a lot of research to be done directly linking these changes to gender bias norms. So we've studied, again, female labor force participation, but not as much the gender norms. I think there's also interesting complexities. So for example, there's an interesting experimental study amongst elite MBA students where you see these female students not willing to take on certain opportunities that would be very good for their future careers because they're also wary of signaling that they're not too ambitious in the potential marriage market.
Wow. So
they believe still, all else equal, men prefer to be professionally dominant to their future wives.
And of course, one of the salient narratives around this was during the Second World War, when many women went to work in the labor force, in factories, traditional male jobs. There is that narrative that that affected gender bias norms. In general, do poverty or the shocks or wars, do they increase or decrease gender bias?
Yeah, definitely. So there's significant research studying the impact of wars.
Mm-hmm.
And partly this is because economists are always looking for sources of identification.
Yeah.
And wars are good ones because they're shocks placed onto the society. There's sort of interestingly two ways of which wars have affected positively reducing gender bias norms. So one is the labor force one you mentioned. So just the fact that women are in the labor force and that they have experience in that, that seems to have long lasting impacts. But also interesting, there's also just a demographic shock. So wars also tend to take more male lives than female lives. Within a given generation that suffered war, you have just more women around than men.
Sure.
They're often living without husbands. They may remain unmarried. And this actually has a positive impact for gender bias norms and marital norms. With regards to poverty, the evidence is less established. I mean, there is evidence that poverty leads to the exacerbation of gender bias norms like child marriage or female infanticide or feeding boys before girls in poorer regions, but that's less well established. There is this big chunk of research establishing the connection to war.
What about the influence of organized religion?
Yeah, that I would say is quite complex and context specific.
Yeah.
So today, for example, Islamic religious codes tend to work to the detriment of women. But for example, when they took foot in the 6th century, they're actually relatively progressive. They protected women with a proper marital contract. They had financial protection from husbands and even had inheritance rights. So this is relatively progressive. Similarly, you can think of like the medieval Catholic Church definitely restricted women and worked to the detriment of gender bias norms. But later on in the colonial period, Christian missionaries tended to have a positive effect on women by promoting female education and discouraging these gender bias practices like child marriage or foot binding or bribe burning and genital mutilation, these kind of things. So again, I think it's quite context specific.
And we often discuss the secularization of society where ideas around how we should participate in the public and private space replace those religious ideas. Do these secular ideas about how society should be organized, do they always undermine these bias norms?
I would say it's complex. I would be hesitant to say always. There's definitely examples.
Yeah, yeah.
So as a generality, again, looking at a global data variation, you see, for example, customary law, which is essentially ethnic or religious based, tends to work to the detriment of women rather to secular law, common law or civil law. And you could take the example, like a big influencing secular idea that positively impacted women was socialism and communism. So for example, there's a lot of evidence coming out of the example of China when the Chinese Communist Party, promoted female labor participation and at the same time discouraged Confucian ideals, which definitely worked to the detriment of women. So that's an example of where it was the case. I wouldn't generalize without acknowledging the context specificness of this.
I remember a few months ago on Vox Talks Economics, we had an episode about the laws, the surprising laws, at least surprising to me, I didn't know anything about them, that had been created in the 19th, early 20th century to protect women in the US. And it did this by restricting their access to male employment. This is an example of an institution that entrenched gender bias norms. Do institutions, I mean, they reflect gender bias norms sometimes. Do they sometimes create them as well?
Oh, definitely. They do both, right? So institutions dictate the rules of behavior within a society. So if there are gender bias laws, of course, there encourages gender bias behaviors. But at the same time, laws and institutions are endogenously interact with social norms and beliefs. So for example, the change in laws that the change in laws that promote gender equality in Western industrialized countries were also a function. I mean, they weren't just a function of economic forces. They were a function of an evolution of changing societal beliefs. And I think this is, again, conceptually, this endogenous relationship is not very well studied in economics for the case of gender norms. And I think it's really interesting area.
So we know that norms can change, often slower than we like. How important is the transmission of these norms from our parents, our peers, our role models in either entrenching or changing these norms?
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
This is where we have the most extensive empirical work, and evidence is demonstrating this exactly over and over again across many contexts. We find evidence of this. And I think one of the most surprising aspects of this is how long-standing norms, which have essentially existed for a millennium, can change in relatively short time spans. We've seen this, for example, in experiments in development economics, where sometimes just giving individuals a short-term information intervention or engaging adolescents in, you know, short-lived discussion groups around gender equality can have significant longer-term impacts. I mean, these are impacts measured only within, you know, the experiment time, so maybe 2 years later, but still, it's surprising that they change so quickly for some norms.
But of course, to be able to change those norms, people have to be comfortable talking about how they should change, talking out loud in public about how they should change. Do our social expectations sometimes prevent us from expressing our attitudes about how norms should change that would undermine these biases, but it's just not discussed?
I mean, I would conjecture definitely so. I think having strong empirical evidence demonstrating this is a bit hard because it's so hard to measure this. But we do have a fair bit of evidence now. There's all this new research with regards to gender norms where they're actually asking, say, men, do you think it's okay if your wife works? And then they ask them, what proportion of men in your society do you think thinks this is okay as well?
Uh-huh.
And then using these surveys, you can compute the actual beliefs because you've asked men what they actually believe. And you tend to always see that men overestimate the bias. So essentially, they are feeling like even though they believe their wife should work, they're believing society thinks their wives shouldn't work on average, believe that. That would suggest that you could be afraid to speak those beliefs because they're essentially, they are living in a what we term pluralistic ignorance. And what's been interesting, these experiments have tried to change these perceptions. So just informing individuals, no, this is the actual average. And then that changes behavior. So that's, again, a very quick fix if it's just a matter of giving information on what the society actually believes.
In listening to people like, well, I mean, Andrew Tate's the obvious name that comes to mind. I mean, I wouldn't recommend this, but it is fascinating in a horrifying sort of way. There is this idea that if women had more power in society, then that's a cost to men. It's a sort of zero-sum game. Is the male attitude to preserving these norms, is it driven by this idea that it is a zero-sum game?
That's definitely a conjecture out there.
I
think there's not as much concrete evidence again. So the backlash phenomenon, though, is certainly something much discussed. I think we could research more. I mean, some concrete evidence we have in economics is when you see women gain relative economic independence or some kind of autonomy within their households, you tend to see more intimate partner violence. So that's sort of a direct reaction. And you also see that men try to take the gains from women. So some people that have studied the historical movements, there were definitely evidence of backlash against pro-women movements. But I think that's something we need to study. And that's something that could change too. Sometimes there's a backlash reaction and then it settles. Men adapt to this new notion of gender equality.
It does sound like there are many important and interesting questions that we could research. What sort of open questions are there in this that you find particularly important, particularly interesting at the moment that you would like to see more research on?
I think it's good for economists to entertain the idea that men and women do not have to have equal economic roles or even social roles to eradicate gender bias norms. The sexual division of labor isn't necessarily a problem in its own right. Economists have mainly focused on this goal to have equal economic roles. I think it's worth separating out our thinking on this. And the role of identity, too, is particularly relevant. Claudia Golden talks about this movement in the West where women not only were forced into the labor market out of necessity, but along the way, women's identity changed. So women now, like myself, think it's valuable to be a professional at the cost of my time as a mother, for example. I think assuming that same identity acceptance will happen elsewhere in the world is not necessarily clear to me. I think the role of mother could play a stronger role. And I think we need to think about these in a much more subtle way and not just move forward always thinking women have to be doing the same thing as men, because I don't think that's necessarily how we have to be to eradicate inequality.
You see, that's very interesting because I came into this conversation really sort of conflating the idea of roles and bias norms. It's so interesting to think about how we could separate them. Is it inevitable that these gender bias norms will be eradicated sort of as a function of development, or is that too complacent and there really should be a much broader role for policy in this?
Yeah, I definitely don't think it's inevitable. Just take legal inequality. So this is formal equality, right? And gender bias norms evolve much slower than laws. So we've reached the closest to equality, but far from perfect in OECD-rich countries. We're far from that in the rest of the world. But added to that, even the correlation between economic progress, so you just take GDP per capita, for example, it's positively correlated with economic rights for women, but not with personal rights within the family, not with protection from violence. If we care about all measures of gender bias norms and gender equality, it's not at all even explaining the correlation. So I would not be complacent at all.
We've only just scratched the surface of what you wrote in this article, so I would recommend everybody download it and read it. There are so many interesting questions. It's one of those papers that you read and then you think about it for days afterwards. Thank you for talking about it today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
The discussion paper is discussion paper DP20211, Gender Biased Norms. And the author, of course, Chuan Anderson.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, is Davos a boondoggle?